Hillary Clinton plays defense for a change.
From the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI, this is Columbus on the Record. Joining Mike Thompson this week, Jackie Borchard, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Julie Carr Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Dale Butland, Democratic strategist, Gene Krebs, former state legislator.
For most of this campaign, we in the media and voters have focused on Donald Trump's unorthodox candidacy and his controversial statements. This week, primary attention shifted to Hillary Clinton. At issue is her family's foundation, the Clinton Foundation, which raises hundreds of millions of dollars to help impoverished people around the world. The problem is many of those donors are foreign and have business with the U.S. government, namely the State Department, which Clinton ran for 4 years. The Associated Press this week reported half of the private citizen meetings or phone calls with Secretary of State Clinton were with donors to the foundation. Trump calls the situation pay to play, while the Clinton campaign denies a conflict of interest.
It's impossible to tell where the Clinton Foundation ends and the State Department begins.
By our count, there were over 1,700 other meetings that she had. You know, she was Secretary of State. She was meeting with foreign officials and government officials constantly. So to pull all of them out of the equation, cherry pick a very small number of meetings is pretty outrageous.
Julie Carr Smythe, even as this story was coming out, the Clintons were doing something to separate themselves from the foundation. Bill Clinton basically said he'll step aside if Hillary Clinton becomes president.
Right. They obviously are aware that if she becomes elected, regardless of this situation, that this might present a conflict. So he had said he would step down. They would no longer be accepting donations from corporate entities and that kind of thing. Now, in the ensuing days, we've discovered that Chelsea Clinton, it's their intention that she would remain at the top of the foundation, even though her father would then not be associated with it. So it it's a bit of a complication for them, I guess, at this point in the campaign.
Dale, is that enough? I mean, some Democrats have called for the foundation to be shut down, transferred to another organization to separate completely the Clintons from this foundation's work.
From a purely political point of view, that would probably be a good idea. But I think, I mean, I understand why the Republicans want to make this a big issue, but I think it's important that we not lose sight of two important facts. Number one, it's true that what these emails show is that Hillary Clinton sometimes took meetings with donors. But there is not one shred of evidence that she ever took an official or inappropriate action of any kind with respect to those donors. Number two, not a single dime from the Clinton Foundation, which is, by the way, as you mentioned, is doing some really great work, saved thousands of lives around the world. 50% of all the people in the world getting treatment for AIDS are getting their medications from this foundation. But the Clintons have never taken a dime from this. Bill Clinton runs it, doesn't even take a salary. So I think it's important that we, in fact, they've even given $1 million of their own money to this foundation. So it's not like there's any money going into their pockets from this.
Jackie, this goes to the argument that even Bernie Sanders made, that it's a closed loop. The establishment has their supporters and they get access to the White House. And it's not unique to Democrats either.
Right. And even though there may not be evidence right now of a specific act that was that Clinton did on behalf of any of these donors, access alone is considered, when you're talking pay to play, considered to be enough to, you know, raise that doubt of, you know, well, what about all the people who might have concerns that didn't donate to the Clinton Foundation?
Donald Trump donated $100,000 to the Clinton Foundation, Gene?
Yeah, just proving he was looking for access like apparently everybody else was. When you use the words pay to play, I have an immediate traumatized flashback back to the days of Vern Reif here in State House, Paul Jones, and pay to play only requires two or three incidences to have it be significant. And I think what we're seeing here is unfortunately, Hillary has a brand. For her, the negative part of her brand is situational ethics, situational politics. This type of story only continues to feed it. If she's smart, she will simply say to the Rockefeller Foundation, hi, here's a bunch of money, go out and do good. And Chelsea should not be on the board. Bill should not be on the board. They need to divorce themselves of this completely. They're doing good. That's a separate issue. It's about the optics of it.
One of the things, I mean, with regard to pay to play, the play part implies that there's some sort of official action that's being taken. A meeting with somebody and letting them talk about foreign affairs, which many of these people were in there to do, I don't think qualifies. But let me just say, I think I don't understand why there's not more focus now on what I regard as the real money-related scandal that's going on in this campaign, and that is Donald Trump's continuing refusal to release his income taxes, which allows him to hide not just how much he makes or and where he gets it from, but also how much he's paying in taxes, what his charitable contributions are, and the extent of his relationships with foreign interests. We know from the New York Times last Sunday that his businesses are at least $650 million in debt to organizations like the Bank of China. So I think that's a little more important than which donors met with Hillary Clinton about her charity.
I think most of those on my side, I would like to say, can we see all the transcripts of all Hillary's speeches? So there's a fair amount of...
Seen 10 years of Hillary Clinton's tax returns, and Trump is the first candidate from either party in 40 years who hasn't released his returns.
That's not the key thing. The key thing on our side is we want to know what she was saying in these closed-door meetings. Look, the solution to this is to have... If you want to become a candidate... Just videotape your life for everybody all the time. Then we'll know.
Getting back to the access issue, I think it's very difficult to say when someone has the ear of an important official like this that access doesn't have an impact, regardless of a written signature on something or a vote on something, a contract, a formal action, because of the fact that you're influencing a whole array of concepts that are coming out of the State Department.
Jackie demonstrated in the Netflix show House of Cards. The primary character's wife has a nonprofit, and there's access issues going on there and favors. And Mike DeWine has a charity, which he helps folks in Haiti. We've talked about Elizabeth Dole with the Red Cross. There's always this sort of cross-pollination, no matter who you're dealing with in Washington, it seems.
Right. And pay-to-play, in the most formal definition, even the loose definition, it's really hard to prove, extremely hard to prove. And, you know, the best that I think the journalists and that the AP tried to do was at least say, look, we looked at it, and this is what we found. And there is a paragraph in that story that says, you know, this doesn't draw a direct link, but this is who was there. This is how much they gave. People should know
you
about
decide.
It. And it doesn't really matter if you ever to find anything directly. No smoking gun, but at least we're finding shells on the floor. And it goes to the issue of the optics and the appearance. And in this case, like Caesar's husband, she has to be above reproach.
Well, let me just say, I worked in Washington for 20 years for John Glenn, who I think most people would regard as one of the more honorable and honest people. I will tell you, the way the system works is, if you have big donors and they ask for a meeting, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, every single day in the Congress of the United States, every House member and every Senate member takes meetings. Now, that doesn't mean that they're trading votes. It doesn't mean that they're doing anything that is illegal or even unethical. But you do. That's what access means. But that's why people give. That's why people open their doors to lobbyists. That's the system that we have, for better or for worse. I personally would like to see the system changed, and so would Hillary. But in the meantime, until we go to public finance and campaigns or something like that, it seems to me that you can't complain about the system as it is.
Let's get to our next topic. The new term that has gained prominence in this campaign is the so-called alt-right. The term describes fringe ultra-conservatives seen as white nationalists who spread their message mainly on the internet. This week, Hillary Clinton denounced Donald Trump's alignment with some of the group's views.
That's what I want to make clear today. A man with a long history of racial discrimination, who traffics in dark conspiracy theories drawn from the pages of supermarket tabloids and the far dark reaches of the internet, should never run our government or command our military.
When democratic policies fail, they are left with only this one tired argument. You're racist, you're racist, you're racist. They keep saying it. You're racist. It's a tired, disgusting argument. The people of this country who want their laws enforced and respected, respected by all, and who want their borders secured are not racists.
Gene Krebs, you're a loyal conservative. How comfortable are you with Donald Trump's courting of this far right?
Not at all. As I've said before on the show, but my problem with Donald Trump, same problem I have with Bill Clinton and Hillary, situational ethics, situational politics. I think the rise of the alt-right, though, I think we have to keep in mind this did not occur in a vacuum. I'll go back to my one of my favorite books I always recommend, everybody to read The Fourth Turning, and you'll see where, you know, let's face it, Bush invaded Iraq. That gave rise to MoveOn.org. That raised the temperature. Tea Party, in response to MoveOn.org, came on, raised the temperature some more. Then you have Bernie Sanders now raising the temperature in response to that. In other words, everything's getting hotter. And for as the book outlines, this rise in temperature will continue here in America for another few years. It's going to be important, though, that we start to dampen it down.
It hasn't happened in this campaign.
No.
I mean, we thought it might. After 2012, the Republicans said we've got to be more welcoming, we've got to open the tent. I mean, and they've gone the opposite direction.
Right. I mean, I remember us seeing these huge rallies, Tea Party conservatives coming up to the State House and talking about the issues that they cared about and that they were going to even take over the party. They didn't exactly managed to do that in Donald Trump, but at the same time, I think that a lot of those sentiments are what's helping him succeed.
Oh, no, because if you listen to those true constitutionalists, they view Donald Trump with pure horror because it's his open-ended interpretation of what the law ought to be, and they're very strict constructionists. So, no, I would.
Think there's still three segments of the party?
Oh, I think probably 77 segments of the party right about now. But as opposed to the Democrats, you only have 144 segments of the party.
Democrats,
and that's what happened after 2012. Is even though there was this kind of autopsy of the party report released, there was no, you know, rallying of the troops and bringing everybody together and. You know, with the internet providing a lot of, it's basically provided a safe space for some of these, you know, far right views, the alt right that Hillary is talking
and
about
far
there,
left.
And far left. But yeah. I mean, that's where the alt right is different from the Tea Party, where the Tea Party you had people showing up at the State House and running for local races. The alt right is more, you know, more exists in. They've been able to find each other through online websites, through Breitbart, the right-wing news organization, of course, which Donald Trump brought on their editor to be his campaign chairman. So,
and that, I think, is what makes this different. Yes, it's true, Gene, that there have always been in the darker recesses of our society this kind of extremism. But what's different is Donald Trump has been mainstreaming it. And he did it by hiring this fellow Steve Bannon, who had been the editor of something called Breitbart. And I encourage our viewers to go on that website and look. It is a fever swamp of racism, nativism, misogyny, anti-Semitism, and outlandish conspiracy theories. Just since that guy Bannon took over, Breitbart has run stories attacking the Pope as a communist, referring to the Civil War as the War of Southern Independence, claiming that Virginia Senator Tim Kaine has links to the Muslim Brotherhood, and asserting, and I'm quoting them directly, birth control makes women sluts. Now, this, you know, it won't be too long before reporters are asking Trump, do you agree with these sentiments? And if the answer is no, then the next obvious question is, then why would you hire the guy who published them to run your campaign?
And how do you explain Saul Alinsky and his terrorist wife being such a major influence in so much of the Democratic Party at this point in time?
They're not.
They
haven't been.
They are huge.
Oh, come on, Gene. This is ridiculous. Are you going to try to tell me that you think there's nothing wrong with this Breitbart?
Oh, I think there's a lot wrong with him. Also, there's a lot wrong with Saul Alinsky and his type. And I've not heard the D's go out there and condemn him
enough. Saul Alinsky is dead.
Because they're afraid of alienating that core ultra-liberal progressive MoveOn.org base.
All right, let's move on to 2020. We'll solve it then. John Kasich was criticized for getting into the 2016 race for president too late. It looks like he's not going to wait as long this time. In fact, it looks like he's already running. 3 months before 2016 votes are cast, Governor Kasich this weekend will be in New Hampshire. The reception to thank 2016 supporters will also prime those supporters for a 2020 race. Jackie Borchardt, what's he doing in New Hampshire?
He's just thanking supporters and enjoying the late summer New Hampshire weather.
Like Winnipesaukee. Yes.
Hiking a little in the early mountains. To see the leaves change up there. But, you know, he hasn't been, since he left the race, he didn't, you know, disappear into a corner, but he didn't also come out and endorse Donald Trump. He's made it pretty clear where he stands at this point, at least, on the presidential race, and that he's going to focus on other things. And one of those things is looking ahead and looking forward. And, you know, clearly he and his campaign believe that he has some sort of a shot in the future. They haven't, you know, totally disbanded the campaign. He's still got staffers on and they've got money. So.
And he's all over the country, really, campaigning for down ticket races, including Marco Rubio and others. And he's trying to keep his name out there, I think. And he's made a gamble. I mean, many people have made a gamble this year, one way or another, on their support for, or lack of it, for Donald Trump on the Republican side. And I think he's made a gamble that this is going to work well for him in 4 years and that he can just sort of keep the ball rolling.
Gee, doesn't he have a job now?
Actually, he does, and he's in his, and I, you know, if you talk to folks who are hanging around the State House quite a lot, he's in there quite a lot and is making a lot of work. And I think this goes to one of the core issues. We're going to see a very activist budget being released here in a few months. You've already heard some stories about what's going on in there.
So he's engaged at the State House, even though he's spending his weekends in New Hampshire and Florida and other places.
There's a thing called an airplane. You can get around.
Yeah, I know.
Well, look, I mean, you really can't blame John Kasich, given the disaster that's the Trump campaign, for thinking about 2020. But I think he's going to have a couple of problems. Number one, he leaves office in 2018. He's going to need a platform, which he does not now have, to keep himself in the national spotlight and to keep him relevant. Second, and maybe even more important, by 2020, John Kasich will be 68 years old. Now, that's not ancient by, you know, any means.
Same as Hillary Clinton now.
Yes, but by that time, Kasich's time as chairman of the House Budget Committee will be 30 years past, and with a new generation of Republicans coming up who are in their 40s, like Paul Ryan, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, I think it's going to be difficult for Governor Kasich to escape the perception that he's been around forever.
All right. A couple of decisions this week could have an impact on the fall election. First, a federal appeals court overturned a federal judge who had restored the so-called golden week of early voting, where people could register and vote at the same time. The appeals court restored the state law, which capped that voting at 29 days before the election. And the other decision, Secretary of State John Husted said Libertarian Gary Johnson's name can't appear on the ballot as an independent candidate. Jackie Borchardt, first to the golden week. Is it done now? Are we not going to have the golden week? It's on, it's off.
I mean, this law has been tied up in the courts since it was passed. And right now, where it stands, you had a three-judge panel. Appeals judges say, you know, we're keeping the law. But the Democratic Party, which is the lead, you know, they filed the complaint. They are going to appeal it again to the full panel. And then beyond that, it could go all the way to the Supreme Court. And we've got plenty of time. In 2014, this happened. The same law was challenged, and it did end up going to the U.S. Supreme Court, which granted the state an emergency stay and allowed the rules to stay in place.
How big a deal is Golden Week? I mean, it's symbolic, of course, because it does open the access to folks who aren't registered and just go and do it all at once. But how big of an impact is it?
Well, it depends upon where you sit, of course. If you're in state of New York, Hillary Clinton's home state, quote, they have one day to vote on. In Ohio, we have 28 days, which I will tell you completely changes how you run elections here. The Golden Week, probably a minimum impact overall, but we have a very permissive of all the 50 states. We're probably in the top five on the most permissive attitude towards being able to vote in Ohio. Even a warm body, you can vote.
Except the Republican judge who made the original decision, which restored Golden Week, as he said, the issue is not whether other states have less generous early voting than the state of Ohio does. The issue is how do our laws impact our minority voters. And by reducing this week, this is what the Republican judge said, you've reduced the opportunity for African Americans to vote, and he said that is wrong and unconstitutional, and I think it's going to be overturned on appeal.
So, look, I think that it's going to be a big, I think it's a huge deal, because to me the number one issue this year is going to be turnout. We have two still continue to be some of the most unpopular two for, nominees for president, and I think that whether people want to come to the polls, the more chances they have to do that, the more likely a few people are going to show up and perhaps vote.
Organization is key, and that goes to the Golden Week and early voting. Organization is key. Our last topic, once again, bureaucracy and politics are keeping state officials from increasing oversight of Ohio charter schools. The state legislature last spring passed a reform law that called for an evaluation of charter school sponsors. The evaluations were to be released this fall, but a Republican-led legislative panel blocked the evaluations, saying they were being done improperly. Charter school critics call it a delaying tactic. Dale Butlin, you're one of those charter school critics, at least the oversight critic of the oversight process. What's going on here in your mind?
Well, I'm a critic of bad charter schools.
Yeah.
So here's what happened. Last year, after Ohio's charter schools literally became a national laughingstock, the legislature finally took action and passed a law to bring some oversight and accountability to these schools. But ever since that time, the for-profit operators who run many of these charter schools and who get literally tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money to do it, and then in return give millions of dollars in campaign contributions to the Republicans who run the state, have been screaming bloody murder. So now you've had an obscure and Republican-led rulemaking committee has blocked the state education department from enacting those evaluations of charter sponsors, which may mean that we have no accountability reforms at all for at least another year.
It's not my intention to toss the Department of Education under the bus, but the bus will soon thump. In April, they should have had their meeting on this topic to begin to establish the rules. I can't explain why they chose not to have the meeting. They got behind on the bureaucracy, probably due to the fact they were, without a true head at that point in time, I think.
But the superintendent.
The superintendent was leaving and all that. The core of the whole problem, everything would have worked. And so you can't say the General Assembly is completely on the take. At the same time, they also passed very strenuous rules. The matter comes down to April. The Board of Education missed their key date. And the other problem is that they came through and they tried to establish retroactive legislation, so to speak. And that made, especially the lawyers, and JCAR is not an obscure body, that made the lawyers on JCAR froth at the mouth.
JCAR is the panel that blocked this. We're getting really deep in the weeds here, but
obscure, one
were,
might say.
Yeah. Right, no. their primary concern, and even lawmakers that support this rule and these regulations, they said it would set them up for a lawsuit because it would go retroactive back to the beginning of the month.
And there's been a lot of conversation that somehow this delay is going to jeopardize the $71 million in charter school money from the federal government to good quality charter schools. As of this week, at the end of this week, the Department of Education is saying they don't feel that's the case, that the conversations are still open with the federal government, and that this is just going to be a one-week additional comment period, and that everything else is going to go ahead and go forward.
Because the law is still in place. It's just implementing the law that is the question.
Right, and they have different deadlines to get that done. And
Could, on a politics question, Jackie, could the lawmakers who don't want to annoy the charter school operators be putting this in the State Department of Education's lap to let them be the bad guy so they don't have to do it? Is that happening here?
I don't think so.
They're asking Kasich administration to clamp down on it.
Oh, I think it's really a matter of the timeline and the Board of Ed and the department between the two of them not getting everything together in adequate time. But like I said, there are lawmakers on that panel who voted against it, who said, there's another way to get this done. They're not opposed to it actually happening.
If it's not a short delay, the Akron Beacon Journal put it best this weekend. in an editorial. They say Governor Kasich has to step up and use his authority to implement an emergency rule that restores evaluations and accountability. If he doesn't, Ohio will go back to being a national laughing stock, and taxpayers will be ripped off, and kids will not be educated.
All right, time for our final off-the-record parting shots. Gene, you're up first.
Normally, I give short shrift to conspiracy theories, but it is baffling to me as to how the media, sorry, ladies, savaged W. Bush on his inattention to Katrina and has given a complete pass to President Obama on his total lack of attention to the recent flooding and worse flooding in Louisiana. This, I think, explains why so many Bobby and Betty Buckeyes view the mainstream media with some pause.
Dale.
Well, if you've been watching the news this week, you know that when it comes to immigration, Donald Trump has more positions than the Kama Sutra. But he's between a rock and a hard place. 70% of the voters don't like his mass deportation plan, but he's not going to win them over by telling them, in effect, if you didn't like my immigration policy, the good news is you can't trust me either.
Julie.
I'm just going to use my final moment to go back to when I was talking about the Tea Party versus the ultra-right, not to compare them in that way, but just to say that I think there are a lot of Ohio voters out there who are reflected in the fact that they don't like the mainstream, and that's why we have Donald Trump right now on the Republican side. And so whether or not they decide to come out will be interesting this fall.
And Jackie.
Well, we are, even though, you know, election is in November, now is the time to register to vote, to start paying attention to the issues and the candidates, because from here on out, you're just going to be flooded with ads telling you one way or the other, and we all know what those are out to do.
Black and white, look out for the black and white, grainy, ominous voices coming up in the next 2 months. That is Columbus on the Record. Check us out online, Twitter, Facebook, our website, WOSU.org, for our panel, for our crew. Have a good week.